So then all your taxi services, all of the delivery services, all of the economic vibrancy of that city is going to die with it. Because what, is somebody going to carry a big parcel on his back on a bicycle to get it?
What I'll do is I'll send you the link to the article. You can read it for yourself. And then I can honestly tell you, when I first saw the title and I started reading, I was like, this guy's nuts. He's stupid. He's smoking crack or something.
But I still think so.
When you read, when you finish reading it, you're like, okay, I see where you're coming from, but I still think you're a nut job.
I think that's a nut job. So if Mumbai is number one in the world in terms of traffic congestion, Cape Town comes in at 90th, and Joburg comes in at 105th, and Pretoria, Bobby, comes in at 182, position 182.
We don't have as large a problem as the Joburg people.
Unbelievable. And congestion levels by time of day. So all around the world, it's similar, but Monday to Friday between 6 a.m. and about 8:30 a.m. is where the congestion is, and then at about 2:30, believe it or not, the traffic starts around the world and subsides at around 6 p.m. But believe it or not, if you have a look at this chart, on a Friday, the traffic congestion already starts at midday. So I wonder, you know, whether people actually work around the world on a Friday afternoon.
Well, Cape Town, as you well know, George, 12:30 on a Friday afternoon, Cape Town shuts down. You can't get anything done because a lot of the guys go to religious services.
Yeah.
They go to mosque. And
well, there's a chart here for Cape Town, and Cape Town's the worst on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, because everybody's left work and they're going to religious service, or they're just saying, you know what, I've had enough. Time to get the weekend started early.
Let me go get my mountain bike and go up the mountain, bro. Oh,
yeah. One of those.
Joburg follows suit, but on a Friday afternoon is not as bad as Cape Town. So you're right.
Well, look, I used to work as a dispatcher for. I used to dispatch delivery vehicles.
Yeah.
And we would only send the trucks out after 10 o'clock in the morning, so that they could avoid the rush hour. And they had to be back by 3:30 in the afternoon, because if they weren't, then it meant I was closing up the warehouse at 7 o'clock at night, because that's when they would get back. So yes, I can confirm. You watch the traffic and say, you know, okay, well, if the driver's not back yet, well, I might as well get comfortable because my weekend's now ruined.
Yeah. Well, you know what? There, I always say, to the team at Autotrader, you know, there's two things you've got to have to be successful. One is you need to be a little bit smart, okay? So you need to have a certain level of smartness. You need to be able to
street smart.
Street smart, you know. I've got a whole other theory on education, but you need to be smart, and you can accumulate that in a number of ways: education, or life experience, or reading, or whatever the case may be. But then there's another element to success, and that is hard work, okay? So those are the only two you really need, is hard work. And, you know, I don't know if I believe in luck because of what Gary Player said. But you know, so when I see charts like that, I'm like, woohoo, guess what? I'm just going to outwork everyone else.
Yeah.
On a Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
Hey?
My opinion on the...
when it's quiet.
Yeah. On the work ethic is most people stop working anywhere at 3 o'clock, irrelevant of the industry that they're in.
Yeah.
They just have to be there until 5. That's why they stay there until 5 or 4:30 or whatever. So
busy browsing social media.
Mostly.
So that's the opportunity, is, you know, those traffic congestion stats are interesting, because it shows you that, you know, there's very little competition on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
Everyone's in their car. Anyway, so... moving on to the next story, which is around Polo Vivo sales, and you know, VW Polo has no intent of letting up as it continues to dominate the sales in the passenger car market, and racked up sales of 2,478 units in the last month. Do you think the Polo Vivo's numbers are ever going to fall?
No.
What
are they doing right?
They sell to fleet people on the one side.
Okay, so we keep coming back to this fleet.
It's not only that, but okay, George, I know what the answer is, but what was your first car?
My first car was a VW Passat.
Okay, my first car was a VW Golf.
Yeah, my second car was a VW Golf. That was 6 months later.
Okay. City Golf.
City Golf.
Yeah.
City Golf.
What replaced the City Golf?
The Jetta. Polo.
That's true.
It is still the car that everybody, it's their first car.
Yeah,
and you know, there are hundreds of thousands of them on the roads. So much so that you cannot drive in traffic or on the freeway in the morning without spotting at least six in, you know, a 10-meter radius around you at some given point. I think it's just their sheer numbers, their replaceability, and the fact that it's such an easy car to drive.
And I suppose because there's so many on the road, there are so many parts available because, you know, they would have crashed.
Excellent after-sales support.
Yeah.
And on top of that, let's not take away from the fact that the current Vivo is still very much up to date with other super minis as well.
Exactly. Yeah. The thing is, I think the only time the Polo Viva's numbers will fall or disappear is when they replace it with a new model.
Yeah.
And change it from Vivo to some other German name, because, you know, that's what they did with the Golf. It's not the Mark 1 anymore. It's now the Vivo. So, yeah, it's going to be around for a long time and will continue to be around for years after that, because you still see Mark 1 Golfs on the roads today.
And that I loved that car. I mean, I had the 1500 Golf. 1500 GLS. Engine. GLS, yes. Yeah. It was like this vomit green color.
Welcome to the 70s.
Emerald bottle green.
What are you trying to say?
I had a yellow city.
A yellow city Golf. Oh, one of those white and yellow city Golfs. I loved those cars. But rumor has it that that those cars were discontinued because they didn't have enough crumple zones and they were an accident nightmare.
They actually had crumple zones, and by the end they had ABS. They had airbags as well.
Welcome to the 70s back again.
But
they didn't have airbags.
The later ones actually had airbag. Well, at least one airbag for the driver as well. But I
technology
think in the end,
marches
after
on.
A 25-year production run,
technology marches on. It has
and
to be
the tooling had worn out. I'm pretty much convinced that the tooling on the City Golf had worn out.
Yeah, probably. They would have had to retool at some point. And then on to the next story. South African hijack car theft rates are at an all-time high. This is sad to see. According to CarTrack, it will be difficult to identify any specific areas of risk, but the numbers are alarming. CarTrack has seen a significant increase in subscribers in the last couple of years, reporting 28% rise in subscriber growth for the year ended now February 2019. And they sit on 975,000 subscribers. You know, they say that their experience is that car thieves are becoming more sophisticated. I mean, let's look at the lock scenario that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago with the Ford Fiesta. Yeah. And Bobby and I were talking about it the other day when I was out there. is it a case that vehicle manufacturers are becoming less sophisticated in locks because the lock's not being used?
Yeah.
And that's why the criminals are becoming more creative in that particular area of opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, some of the latest cars you unlock with your cell phone. So it connects to your phone. As soon as you walk to the car, it unlocks. So it's all software, no hardware protection. That,
yeah.
I mean, that most, you know, I read up a lot about it. Most car thieves open a car in less than 10 seconds.
Unbelievable. You told me a story about, you know, cars being stolen from your
showroom floor. And we've got video footage of a guy pulling up next to a car. It was a Nissan. He was busy with the vehicle for about 35 seconds. The car was gone. 35 seconds.
Yeah. Wow.
And he was gone. We've got the keys, the spare keys. He just hotwired it and left.
Look, it's never going to stop. But, you know, when you have like CarTrack, what it does is it brings down your insurance premiums, number one. And number two, it increases the chances that you might get your car back and that the guys who pinched it are going to get caught. It's not going to stop them from, if a criminal wants something, he's going to take it. It's just how long it's going to take him. That's we now have a number, 35 seconds.
I think another reason why the tracking devices are on the rise, most insurance companies require you to fit a tracker if your vehicle is above a certain value. Above 250,000, you have to. It's non-negotiable. Irrelevant of the car you drive.
Which is a good thing.
Yes.
You know, and I believe these tracking companies are pretty effective at recovering or locating the cars. I haven't heard too many incidents of the cars actually going missing. There have been a few stories, but you don't hear it in the news saying, "Oh, tracking systems don't work."
Well, they
I think
do
by
work.
And large they do.
They absolutely do work. but right up until our borders. They can track the car across the border into Zim or Mozambique.
But they can't retrieve it.
But once it's crossed the border, they'll never get it. I can tell you, okay, well, it went across the border.
Yeah.
Cheers, say goodbye. You know, it's midnight spares.
So now you've got to ask yourself, well, you know, there are clear statistics that show that 90% of the time our cars are parked. We're not driving them.
Yeah.
So 90% of the time our cars are parked. So that means your car is being stolen in that 10 to 20% range of you having driven it, because very rarely is your car stolen out of your garage at home. You know, most people live in secure areas and they put their car behind a locked up gate or garage. So I'd be interested to know the incidence of theft based on the activity of the car, rather than, you know, 90% of the car time is standing still. So that means the incidence of theft in that time period that you're actually using your car is high in relation to the total time that car is alive with you or in your possession. Mm. So, you know, I think it's terrible that these stats are going up.
Yeah, but at the same time, I also regularly see in traffic people sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic with their windows open.
On the phone.
And then they're very shocked. Absolutely shocked when someone reaches in through their window, grabs their car keys or their phone, mm-hmm. or just yanks them out the car.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And it can happen anywhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving swiftly along, do electric vehicles have a future in South Africa? What do you think, Bobby?
Absolutely. I think it is the future, and it's coming, and nobody can stop it.
You can't stop it.
No.
I think we are subject to one particular phenomenon, and that is, our cars and what cars we get are dictated by Europe.
Yes.
And because it's dictated by Europe, if Europe goes electric, we have no chance not to. But where is the crunch? And I've always, I've said the crunch is going to come where if we don't build the infrastructure over time, we're going to have this increasing curve of pressure to implement infrastructure, which means that if there's increasing pressure to transform the country into what is needed for electric cars, what is going to happen with the old ICE cars? We're going to get aging secondhand vehicles in the country's fleet. So, do you think the country's going to keep up with the infrastructure growth?
I think so, because if you go back to the manufacturers that sell the most vehicles. I mean, it's manufacturers that, like you said, sell in the European market, in the American market. So they'll be forced to enforce the infrastructure growth in South Africa, in my opinion.
Yeah.
With I know with BMW with their electric vehicles. Yes, they don't have charging pods all over the country, but most malls do have, and that's a good start.
Well, I was surprised to learn that most malls have charging points. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
There is a certain amount of infrastructure.
Yeah.
And infrastructure or charging points per electric car, which I suppose is a bad stat to look at, is the highest in the world, because we have low volumes, but we have more charging points than the volumes of cars that are on our road. So I'm hoping that the infrastructure gets better in the country.
Well, this actually brings us to another story for later down, where BMW and Jaguar Land Rover announced their cooperation on electric motors, transmissions, and power electronics.
No, the cooperation. I mean, there was a story in the news about a week and a half ago. FCA and the Mitsubishi Renault Alliance, they're planning on joining forces. FCA is wanting to buy in, and they want a part of the North American market in exchange for their electric technology.
Yeah, we'll see if that's going to happen, because on Friday there was now a report that the whole merger is now off. And now this morning I see a report but they've now tabled a new proposal.
It's on, it's off, it's on again.
It sounds like an Italian, it sounds exactly like a romance between an Italian and a French.
The thing is, though, we I think we've spoken about it before, where we've said, you know, at some point there is going to be a convergence of ideas, and it's going to be BMW, Mercedes, Volkswagen, Ford, all the alliances, the different manufacturer groups. They're all going to have to come together at some point to standardize on a plug, standardize on a system, And then the world will have to adopt and say, right, that is an EV charging plug. And it's going to be the same whether you're in America, whether you're in Europe, whether you're in Mexico. It doesn't matter. All the charging points will be exactly the same, and like a petrol station, all the nozzles fit. Yeah. It has to be the same.
That's true. I mean, you can't say that for electric plugs, because you go to Europe, you've got a different electrical socket. You go to America, there's a different electrical socket. You come to South Africa, there's a different... Where do we get our electrical sockets from, as a matter of fact? I've never really thought about that.
It actually,
it's like I've never seen them around the
our
world.
Our local ones actually evolved locally.
I did it.
There's a whole other story behind it.
Okay.
But like our adoption of fiber internet and smartphones...
Yeah.
It's going to trundle along until eventually everybody realizes, oh crap, we better get on board now. And then there's that curve is just going to, it's going to take off. All of a sudden you're going to see people digging up roads left, right and center, laying down cables, pods. Every single petrol garage is going to have a pod to charge a car. They're going to be outside shopping malls, schools. It's going to happen.
It'll happen.
We just don't know when.
Anyway, so let's move on to Formula One. Did you watch it the weekend?
I watched the highlights package.
You watched the highlights package. Well, yeah. I think you missed the best race of the season so far. Wandile couldn't join us today, but he sent us a rundown of the events of yesterday. It was nail biting. I was on the edge of my seat from start to finish.
I was watching the live timing, but
okay. Okay, but it was absolutely nail-biting. I'd say that's what Formula One should be about, is on your edge of your seat. You don't know who's going to win. And the FIA stuffed it up in the end, in my opinion, but we'll talk about that in a second. So let's get to Wandile and hear what he has to say. Oh, sorry.
In an unprecedented turn of events, the 2019 Canadian Grand Prix has brought us probably the best race of the season thus far. It was a race filled with drama, filled with some of the most nail-biting action, and a race that's probably going to be remembered for not the racing per se, but rather a decision that was made by the FIA. Sebastian Vettel would start the race in first place, followed by Lewis Hamilton in a Mercedes, and another Ferrari, that of Charles Leclerc. Positioning would stay that way for much of the race, but on lap 48, Sebastian Vettel made a fatal error, an error which would ultimately mean that he would get a 5-second penalty and give away the lead that he had built for 48 laps to that of Mercedes Lewis Hamilton. How would this all happen? Well, let me tell you. On lap 48, race leader was under pressure from Hamilton and mistakenly ran over some grass on the third turn. This would mean that Sebastian Vettel would have to re-enter the track, but unfortunately due to this error, Hamilton was really, really close. So much so that he would ultimately have to squeeze Hamilton. A mistake that will probably be disputed for the next season, but that's what racing is. Outside of this intense drama, we'd see the second Mercedes finish in fourth, that of Valtteri Bottas. Red Bull's Max Verstappen finish in 5th. The Renaults of Daniel Ricciardo and Nico Hülkenberg finished in 6th and 7th, if I may highlight. What an incredible race that Danny had after such a dreadful start to the season. In 8th place, Pierre Gasly would continue his, I guess, uninspiring run so far in a Red Bull. And Lance Stroll finishing 9th in his home race, starting from 18th, which I think for me was probably my favourite driver of the day, I'd say. And lastly, to finish the points, was Danny Givat, who also had some incredible driving with some of the best overtakes we've seen this entire season. All in all, what an insane race. And George, I don't know what else to say. I'm sure that you also extremely disappointed by the results, but that's F1 for you. My name is Wandile Sishi, and that is me signing out. Back to the studio. Thanks, George.
Well... That was an incredible turn of events, and thank you, Wandile, for doing that. He's our resident F1 expert, and just to add to what Wandile said, Sebastian Vettel on Saturday got pole position by the skin of his teeth, 2/100 of a second, or 2/10 of a second, should I say, and Lewis Hamilton was on his tail, and then Leclerc got third on the starting grid, and that's the way it stayed for much of the race. I don't know what happened to Valtteri Bottas. He's I think he showed his inexperience yesterday, just like Leclerc has over the last couple of races. But it was nail biting. If you have recorded that particular race, go and watch it. It was worth its salt, and there's a lot of controversy because Sebastian Vettel got a 5-second penalty for leaving the track. He spun out a little bit, left the track, went onto the grass, didn't have control over the car, rejoined the track with no control, almost crashed into Lewis Hamilton, and then the steward said, oh, you should have joined the track in a more orderly fashion. How do you do 200 kilometers an hour snaking all over the place onto the track, and then the steward say to you, oh, you should have had control of your car?
Oh, I mean, they get the big bucks. They should know how to do this.
Oh, yeah. I want to see anybody control
their
car.
I watched the incident in question,
yeah,
and the radio chatter. And it was like,
unbelievable.
I had nowhere to go. I had nowhere to go, and I didn't see him. Why do Formula One cars have rear mirrors?
What, about the size of your forehead?
Now, look,
the halo is in the way, man.
If you watch it, he had nowhere to go.
He didn't have anywhere to go. I mean, the wall was right there, and it was on a turn.
But he cocked up. He made the mistake.
Of course he made the mistake, but the 5-second penalty is a bit harsh.
What would have happened if he had come out onto the track and sideswiped Lewis into the wall?
Well, then both of their races would have been over. But you got, I mean,
that'll happen. That's why the stewards made the decision that they did. Because they deemed it to be, well.
Did you see what he did afterwards, though?
Yeah. And I thought it was absolutely hilarious.
It was
and
hilarious.
Absolutely childish.
It was.
But like, it
shows Vettel's lack of maturity, I think. Yeah. Because, you know, we've always said the reason he's not winning to the level that he can win
is being a petulant child.
Because he gets so emotional and he can't direct that emotion and channel it to winning races. He directs it in the wrong direction. And that was evidence at the end of the race. I'm a Sebastian Vettel fan, but hey, Sebastian, shouldn't have done that.
Look, I'll say this. Formula One this season needed this to happen because it was becoming boring.
It was becoming a procession.
1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. Oh, wait a minute. Something's actually going on. Let's see what happens now, because I want to see if they're going to carry this through into the next race, or if they're just going to go,
No, I reckon they should, you know.
The next race will be interesting. Where's the next race?
The next race is in Europe.
Paul Ricard.
Paul Ricard. I'll tell you, where is Paul Ricard? So is it in France?
Yeah, it's in Marseille.
There we go. Okay.
Marseille.
That's in 2 weeks' time, and then... And then we'll see if this fight actually continues. But
yes, hoping.
On to the man of the moment, Bobby Petkoff, and from Mitmac Motors. So you know, Bobby's been here for the last just under 40 minutes listening to us banter on. But I'm very interested to learn about Mitmac Motors, Bobby, you know, an overview really at the beginning of how did you get into this? How did it all start?
Well, back in 2005, just after I matriculated, started working for a dealership. Well, still from Standard 9, matric, part-time. Loved the industry, loved working with people, and loved selling. I think out of all my love, selling is the one that I love the most.
There's two things that trump everything, right? and that is sales and marketing.
Absolutely.
Because you can have the best product on the planet, you can't sell the freaking thing.
And if nobody knows about you, you can't market or you can't sell it to anybody.
Exactly.
Yeah. And opened Mitmac Motors late 2005 with 3 or 4 small cars, and just
where did you open that first?
In Pretoria North. Actually. Okay. About 50 meters away from where our head office is right now. Yes.
Okay.
And gave my, as a young man, gave my 20s, all my 20s, 7 days a week. You know, getting 6:30 in the morning, leave 8:30 at night. And grew the company to 3 branches. We're doing over 200 cars a month now.
Gee whiz. I mean, the last time we spoke about your units, you did way over 200. You did over 238 vehicles, right?
Yeah.
Which is phenomenal, all the way from 5 in 2005.
Yeah.
So what kind of vehicles does Mitmac stock? What kind of ranges do you stock? What, you know, what is your philosophy around that, that mix?
We've got an interesting saying, you know, student to president. So we'd love to help the youngster starting off with a Polo Viva, you know, as a first car. And I'm very interested, you know, through the sales process, who his father is, who his uncle is, who his friends are, who he meets with, and you know, try and accommodate them as well.
Yeah, yeah. So you stock a wide range of, yes, of vehicles. So then the success of your dealerships doesn't sound like it's playing in a particular a segment of make or model that's made you successful, because you carry such a wide range. And so then I'm very interested to understand what makes Mitmach unique. What makes you successful if it's not focusing on one particular segment of car?
We as we had a previous discussion, we focus mainly on the client, and you know, focus all the energy on the client and what we can do for the client, what the needs are, what the specific wants are, what the installment is. And, you know, if I put all my energy on the client, you know, the answer, if you put your energy on the question, the answer will come. And once I've realized, okay, this person is actually looking for a small bucky to run his business, he can afford to pay 3,000 rand a month, I present him with options and point him in the right directions, because most people today don't know what they're looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to, you know, it's like a little puzzle.
Yeah.
A couple of good questions, good quality questions will lead you to the answer.
So what you're saying is part of your success is focusing on the customer's needs and really finding out what the customer wants and what they're after. Because a lot of businesses, and I'm pretty sure a lot of dealerships, they would say the same thing. You know, I focus on what the customer wants. But that could be cliche. It could be just a plaque up on a wall somewhere. So you said something interesting. You know, you ask a couple of very clever questions.
Yes.
And therein, you know, it sounds ludicrous that it's something so small that is so profound. What are the kinds of questions you ask your customers when they walk onto your floor?
I mainly first focus on the vehicle that he is driving, because 90% of the clients have a trade-in. I'll find out what you're driving, how old the car is, what you liked about your car. So that's very important. Did you enjoy the size of your vehicle? Did you enjoy the fact that it's an automatic or a manual? Then I'll ask, what would you change about the car? What can this vehicle that you currently drive, how can it improve? Does it need to go faster? Does it need to go off-road? And you know, based on that, sort of paint a picture. The gentleman or the lady is basically looking for something similar, just newer, with a warranty and a service plan, and build it on from there.
Okay.
But I'd first focus on the trade-in.
Sounds like you focus on getting to know the customer's world, you know, and how they operate in the world in terms of their vehicle, what they like, what they don't like, and then you said an interesting thing. Now, you focus a little bit on what is your current car lacking.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I suppose human beings can talk to, well, I don't like this car because,
yes,
rather than talking to, well, I want X, Y, and Z.
Yes.
You know, because often X, Y, and Z is pie in the sky. Everybody wants to drive a McLaren F1.
Yeah.
But if you focus on what is this car lacking, you get a lot more information out.
Absolutely. I mean, then you'll get an answer like, you know, we're expecting a child. It's a two-door. It immediately gives you insight into... I try and place myself in the client's shoes.
Yeah.
First of all, what would I do? Well, how will I approach this problem? Because, I mean, we're solving problems. Sales is just solving a problem.
Yes.
So what problem can I solve for you? But I can't obviously ask you, what's your problem? What can I do for you? I have to delicately, you know, build the puzzle as to the bigger picture of the problem.
That's proper sales and marketing. It's not just waiting for the customer to come and buy.
Absolutely not.
Is getting the customer's attention. I mean, I'm a big advocate of customer or consumer attention. All we need to do is be where the consumer's attention is. Once you are where the consumer's attention is, then you can ask questions like that and get the sale.
And absolutely, having, you know, you have to execute on your product as well. Your product needs to be, I mean, I know my quality of vehicle is superior to my competitors. It's not even in the same class.
So, I mean, how do you get that right? Because You know, some people might argue, oh, well, one white Polo Vivo is the same as another white Polo Vivo, so the product's the same.
Absolutely not. If you have a look at, let's talk about the Polo Vivo. I don't bat any company down, but a vehicle that has been owned by one or two people is most likely to be in a better condition that everybody else drove. So in terms of a rental car. So I'll give you stats. Uncle Johan owned the car. He sold it to Uncle Fricky. And this is the service history of the vehicle. I have painted the front bumper for, you know, the little stone chips. I've done a rim. It had a mark on the rim. And I present you a vehicle that looks brand new, but it's pre-owned.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you're very interested when you buy vehicles for resale in the history of the vehicle.
Absolutely. It's the only thing that I'm interested in.
Okay, so and therein lies your statement about you have to have a good product.
Yes.
And the way you put that product together is, so what happens if you do get a rental that has been abused?
I'll normally trade a vehicle like that in all the time. It happens daily.
Yeah.
Then I'll move that product to a different dealership. I will not put it on the floor.
Okay. So then you move that to a dealership that specializes in those kinds of vehicles.
In a high mileage or car that had a bit of work done. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So at Mitmac Motors, the history of the car has been looked into. Is what you're saying.
Yes.
You're proud of the vehicles that are on your floor because how do you do this across, how many vehicles do you stock?
It varies. Our stock holding is anything from 500 up, sometimes a little bit less, but it's just having one standard all the time, every day, forever. It's to us, it's irrelevant if I'm buying a Polo or I'm buying a Porsche. I look at the vehicle the same way, I prepare it the same way, and I have it delivered the same way. It doesn't matter what car you bought from me, you feel special, you know, every time you come.
So that kind of probably leads us to the second reason you're so successful in this automotive world of secondhand car dealing. And that is, you can't possibly tell me that you can analyze all 500 vehicles. It's impossible.
It's actually very easy. It's definitely possible. And I've done that by surrounding myself with like-minded people. That was the most difficult challenge I had in my business. And train them to, I mean, at the end of the day, it's my company. They need to act and speak and conduct themselves the way I say is right. So the buyers on the ground, the people that go out to the consumer or to my customers that are selling the vehicles, look at a vehicle the same way that I would. I always train them that you're using your own money, so make sure that you buy the car that you would buy ultimately from Mitmac or a relative would. And by doing that, it's like a standard congruency is what we spoke about off air a while ago. Is it needs to be from start to finish. Every single staff member needs to be in the same mindset all the time.
So on top of having a good product, okay. So, you know, sales and marketing, you've got a very interesting, and I'm starting to see three legs to why Mitmac Motors is as successful as it is. The first leg is, getting consumer attention. That's the marketing bit. Okay. That's probably the easier part, but it is hard for some. And that is really just financial investment and doing the right things and placing the money in the right place. Then you get the consumer into your floor and you ask the right questions.
Yes.
And then on the flip side, you obviously buy cars to sell them. When a car comes in, your product is important from a history check point of view. So you check the history. And I'm probably doing a bad job of describing it back to you because there's so much more to Mitmac Motors than I'm trying to describe. You have such a large range of cars and such a large volume of cars, you doing it all personally, it becomes physically impossible. And therein lies your relentless drive for systems, procedure, process, and making that a standard within your business.
And putting key individuals in place that share the same mindset and share the same vision.
Which is down to culture. Future.
Absolutely. The culture is good. I always say I tend to hire a little bit younger, and that's because the younger generation is more aggressive and more money hungry. They've got a – the younger people have a chip on their shoulder.
They're entitled.
Yeah, you know, irrelevant of race. They want to prove something. Yes. I can do this. I want to show my father. You know, normally it's always the, who would you like to impress the most? My father. Okay, make money by following these steps that I'll teach you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, congruency comes into place, and every single department pushes hard. And sales occur.
Sales occur. And but I mean, it's not that easy. And we're starting to understand why you're as successful as you are. I mean, let's talk about a leadership within your business for a second. And I always say the nicest businesses to work for are the hardest businesses to work for. Why? Because if you're towing the line and you're putting in the effort and you're putting in the time and you're working really hard, it's a nice place to work. If you're not, it's not a nice place to work.
Absolutely. So I believe that education is the key. And in our motor industry, out of the 100 salespeople that I've interviewed, not even one says that we get educated and we get taught new techniques and new ways to sell.
Yeah.
So education is, I think, the biggest key to my success. I give my especially my sales staff, because money is generated from selling.
Yes.
You know, the buying in the profits in the buying and all those nice sayings, you know, it comes down to sales. Yes. If you can sell, you'll make money. If you want to make more money, you need to sell more. So I focus probably, you know, 70-80% of all my energies on training my sales staff and giving them the confidence and the knowledge that they need to actually go and encounter a client and figure out what his problem is.
Yeah.
Because most salespeople, especially in the secondhand industry, you know, buy luck sell cars.
Yeah.
You know, you walk in and you love the color and you've seen five online and you just throw money at the guy and he thinks he's a superhero.
Exactly.
So that's the difference with us. We can actually unlock that little puzzle and give you the right product.
Yeah.
The first time.
Well, I mean, it goes down to, you want to replicate Bobby Petkoff.
Absolutely.
You want to multiply yourself because you've been successful. You've seen the recipe. Now it's getting other people to replicate that. And I've found that is one of the hardest things to do.
Absolutely.
Is you can have the right product, the right process, you can be vigilant at it. The hardest thing to do is to replicate what's in your head. And you've successfully done that, and that's why MacMac is as successful as you are.
I don't think I've successfully done that. My HR department hates me because I fire faster than I hire. But you know, slowly but surely, we are coming right.
Yes. But, I mean, therein lies the trick, right?
Yes.
I think people do hire too quickly and not manage people out quickly enough.
We hire quicker than we fire. That's the key.
You mean you fire quicker than you hire?
I'm sorry. Yeah. We fire quicker than we hire. If you're in a sales position for a week, and I can see you're not a thoroughbred salesperson, and you can teach certain skills, but you need to have that little fire in you. Yeah. If I don't see the fire, this is not for you, at least in this culture. And I've had big managers from other dealerships start with me, and actually while we've been on the radio, one of them quit because it's too hard. She just sent me a WhatsApp. Now she says it's not a place for her. She can't fit in the culture. It's too fast paced.
Yes. Well, I mean, you're not alone, because Auto Trader has a similar sort of philosophy, and it's not for everybody, but those that it is for love it.
Absolutely
love it. Yeah. They thrive on the pressure. They thrive on the speed. So, what's the future hold for MacMac Motors? What does the next year to 2 to 3 years look like for you?
I would love to grow. That's my
dealership footprint.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. We try to acquire property in the east. It's still, you know, under negotiation. Hopefully, we win. We normally do.
Okay.
But later on, move maybe to Cape Town. That's definitely a market where I think my culture will thrive. With I don't say they're all laid back, but the majority of dealers are very laid back there.
Yeah.
Like we spoke earlier, 12:30 to 2 o'clock. Yeah. You know, everybody goes surfing.
Well, I was in Cape Town last week and I visited a dealership by the name of Millstock.
Yes,
and
good dealer.
Louis that owns Millstock, he's a Joburg boy.
Yeah.
And he said to me, he says, "Do you know why I'm successful?" I said to him, why? He says to me, because I'm from Joburg.
why do you think I moved from Cape Town to Joburg? I just got tired of not being able to get anything done.
You just, it's, yeah, I mean, I think there's pockets of success there, but yeah, they are a little bit more laid back. So, so Bobby, you know, where can everybody find you? What is your favorite social media platform, and where are your businesses located?
We're in Pretoria North. I'm always at work. So if the sun is up, I try to beat the sun every day. So
lovely.
If I beat the sun, you know, the day's just gonna be easy. And I go home late, so I'm mostly at my dealership. But Facebook is the platform that I love using. You know, we create a lot of content, a lot of educational material on Facebook. So you can reach me there. My cell phone number is on our website. You can call me. Phone's always on, and I'm there to help you.
Lovely stuff. So Mitmack Motors, and you know, if you remember nothing else, remember mitmackmotors.co.za, right?
Yes.
Is that the right one? Just go there, and all the information will be there. Absolutely. Or come visit Bobby's cars on Auto Trader, and you know, his cars for sale are there as well. So thank you very much for joining us, Bobby. We appreciate your time, and you have a fascinating business.
Thank you very much.
And well done in your success. I hope you take 500 stock units to 1,000.
Thank you very much.
The industry some run for their money.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
On to our very, very last story, and that goes down to what Martin mentioned a little bit earlier on, and that is BMW and Jaguar. BMW and Jaguar Land Rover have jointly developed electric car technology. So we were talking about electric cars a little bit earlier on, and you know, I'm wondering if the future of the automotive industry, we spoke about this before, isn't shared platforms where the success lies in the sales and marketing. Because if you think about an electric car, there's not much to it.
Yeah.
2,000 moving parts in an ICE vehicle, and 10% of that in an electric car. How much technology can you put into an electric car besides the software? It's really just software driven. So is the future of electric cars this sort of world where all the car manufacturers share drivetrains, share even manufacturing plants, and the trick is in who can design the best car? I mean, look at the telephones. The iPhone, its screen, most of its parts are made by Samsung.
And well, let's not get on to the subject of Huawei's.
Well, yeah, no, Huawei's a thing of the past, but in America for now, anyway. But if you think about the commodity called a phone, now
phone is a phone.
It's no longer a you know, the thing that sets this phone apart is its design,
yeah,
and its software. That's what sets it apart, and Apple's ability to market and sell. That's, you know, that's what sets them apart.
Which is pretty much unsurpassed. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So are cars going down the same road? Is a car becoming synonymous to a smartphone?
Well, I believe so. I mean, even BMW and Mercedes-Benz, two serious rivals over the many, many decades they've been around, are now joining forces with new developments.
We're seeing around the world, the joint ventures that are popping up between manufacturers. It has to. Eventually, there has to be a point in the future where it all meets and they're all working together for one common goal, and that's to put electric cars in everybody's garages.
Exactly. Hmm. So, gentlemen, that's been epic. Thank you, Martin. Thank you, Lawrence. Thank you, Bobby.
My pleasure.
And we will be back in the studio in 2 weeks' time. Everybody have an amazing week, and you know, be safe in the traffic.
This is CliffCentral.com.